loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we discuss the newly released documents relating to the surveillance of Trump campaign aide Carter Page and other important developments in the Mueller investigation and the Russiagate hysteria sweeping the country. And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, The Intercept reported over the weekend that the Ecuadorian government will imminently withdraw asylum for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Journalist Glenn Greenwald cites the presence in London of Ecuador's president, Lenin Moreno, ostensibly to speak at a conference on disabilities, saying the actual purpose of the trip is to finalize an agreement with the British government to expel Assange. While the government asserts that they won't remove him during Moreno's international trip, activists are in an intense state of mobilization. Next, President Trump last night issued a furious, all capital letters tweet aimed at the Iranian government, warning that any threats against the United States would be met with dire consequences. The tirade signaled an immediate escalation in tensions between the two countries. Then, a new report on modern slavery around the world has found that the number of slaves in developed countries, including the United States, is much higher than previously thought. In its new report, the Walk Free Foundation says that there are 403,000 slaves in the United States. That's one in every 800 people and seven times higher than previously thought. And then today we continue our segment Education for Liberation, where we look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And finally, ISIS gunmen today stormed a government building in Erbil, the normally peaceful and heavily Kurdish city in northern Iraq, killing one civilian. Kurdish officials said that at least three gunmen were killed by security forces and that the siege is now over. What does this attack say about the stability of Iraq? And in other headlines, U.S. District Court Judge T.S. Ellis III granted Special Counsel Mueller's request to grant immunity to five witnesses in exchange for testimony at President Donald Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort's trial in the coming months. Prosecutors have been ordered to now name these five witnesses and provide a longer list of all 30 witnesses scheduled to testify to Manafort's legal team. A 10-year-old and an 18-year-old were shot and killed and 13 people wounded yesterday in the Greektown neighborhood of Toronto, Canada, on a bustling city street. The shooting suspect walked down the street filled with restaurants while shooting and then exchanged fire with the police. He was later found dead of one gunshot wound. The U.S. Trade Representative's office announced today that it will hold hearings on July 24th and 25th to hear public comments on the proposal to impose tariffs on $16 billion worth of Chinese goods. This proposal is in addition to the U.S. tariffs already on $34 billion worth of Chinese goods. As of Friday, the National Football League put its controversial national anthem policy on hold. This policy stated that players could no longer do anything but stand during the national anthem at games or spend the length of the anthem in the locker room away from public view. The players' union has opposed this rule. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
And now we turn to the latest with the Mueller investigation in U.S.-Russia relations. We're joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net, whose most recent piece is Fighting Fake Stories, The New Yorker, Israel and Obama. We're joined from France by Lucy Commissar. She's a longtime author, editor, and investigative journalist. And we're joined by our own Brian Becker. Welcome to all of you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Yes, me too.
So, Jim, let's begin with you. We got some very interesting news over the weekend about the basis on which the surveillance of Carter Page, Trump campaign aide Carter Page, was done, right? Through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the government needs to submit an application to surveil somebody. And we learned a little bit more about that process. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I did take a look at the FISA document, the FISA application that's been posted. Now, it's kind of hard to read because probably 70% of it is blacked out, so you really don't know all the information they had. But what you saw there is Russian government is a foreign government. This guy was talking to people in Russia, Russians, who some of whom may be connected to somebody, and they might have talked about American policy towards Russia. So therefore, we think he might be a foreign agent. He might be an agent of the Russian government, and we need to surveil him. Okay? He might be about, they actually use the word, he might have be involved in or be about to be involved in crimes, criminal things, things that are crimes in the United States. What you're really seeing here is the whole, the FISA court itself, what a rubber stamp it is. It's easier to get a warrant from a FISA court than it is even to get an indictment, which you can get for a ham sandwich from a prosecutor. So really, it's very thin gruel. The only evidence they have against him that they, that ICE could see that wasn't blacked out was the Steele dossier and news reports. Oh, there's a news report that says that sources tell this news reporter that Page was talking to these people. It's really kind of incredible. They're not saying we have intelligence from that, from our intelligence agencies. They're saying we have a news report about this. And apparently that news report was itself based on Steele's information. So it really just shows you the thin gruel that you need to get a FISA warrant.
Let me ask Lucy, is that normal for press reports to be used in a FISA application? Have you heard of that happening in the past?
We haven't seen FISA applications in the past because this came out because of a FOIA request. It's very unusual. But I have to say, it has to persuade people. It's a little bit ridiculous. Part of it is the argument that this is happening because he talked to some Russians. Some of it was about business, not that other people don't talk about business to other people all over the world. And that the Russians have a history of interfering in other countries and in their elections, and therefore he must somehow be involved with that. We really have to laugh, because if you want to go back to post-World War II, when the Americans interfered in the Italian election, the U.S. government has conducted about 81 electoral interventions in other countries. The Russians did about 36, so that's a big number. And what about overthrowing governments? Iran, Guatemala, Congo, Brazil, Chile. And what about Victoria Nuland? We heard her on the cell phone talking about how they were going to put their guy into the Ukraine. So first we get the guy that he's talking to some business people in Russia, which obviously is a, you know, not allowed. And then we say, and we know that the Russians do all these bad things, therefore he must have been up to no good. But the worst thing is the media taking this seriously, because to me you want to laugh at this. And the real scary thing is not just that this has been written. And Mueller, remember, he was one of the guys about weapons of mass destruction. He was part of that group, right? Remember the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? And so he made that up. And I would think that he made this up, because all that stuff that's blacked out, you're supposed to think they really have evidence. Because when you read this thing, there isn't any evidence. It's, you know, there's nothing there. There's no there there.
Well, that's the thing, too, is we're told so frequently now to just take people's word for it, whether it's the CIA, the FBI, or even the media. They lay something out there, they present it as fact, and they say, just take our word for it, that if you could see what we saw, if you knew what we know, you know, you would believe us. And it's classified, so you can't see it, but you should just take our word for it.
There are people with false identities, and Mueller knows them, but there's no evidence about that. The sophisticated Russians left all these clues in Cyrillic in the internet, and they stole voter data, but it doesn't say what they did with it. How about local election boards denying people the right to vote? Are there going to be investigations about that? I mean, what's interesting to me, and which is not picked up, is actually the opening up the DNC files about Hillary. That was really important. That gave me and other voters information we really needed about the election. So hacking the election really was telling voters the truth about what the DNC and what Hillary Clinton were doing. So I actually am very thankful. I don't know if they did it or who did it. There are lots of stories about how the information about the Podesta files came out, but I'm very glad about it. And all this other stuff seems to me a way of covering up what the real story is, which is out there about how the DNC stole the election from Bernie Sanders. And this just is all a cover-up.
Brian, go ahead. What are your thoughts on both the Carter Page story and the other points that Lucy and Jim have brought up?
Well, one thing is, again, as the other guests have mentioned, the reason we know about the FISA application is the New York Times filed a Freedom of Information Act request, a public records request. They actually sound a little bit unhappy that the Trump administration decided to grant their FOIA request and release the document, as if that, in fact, was a bad thing that the government responded to their public records request. But that said, it's extremely important to pick up on a couple points. One that Jim mentioned, and I want to read a little bit about from the FISA application so our audience fully understands not only the flimsy, the gruel, as Jim put it, the flimsy character of this FISA application to carry out this 24/7 wiretap and surveillance of Carter Page, who was a volunteer with the Trump administration. But there are other chilling elements of the FISA application. Let me read to you. A July 2016 article in an identified news organization reported that candidate number one's campaign, that would be Donald Trump, worked behind the scenes to make sure political party number one's platform, that's the Republican Party platform, would not call for giving weapons to Ukraine to fight Russian and rebel forces, contradicting the view of almost all of political party one, that's the Republicans, foreign policy leaders in Washington. The article stated that candidate number one's campaign sought to, quote, make sure that political party one, the Republicans, would not pledge to give Ukraine the weapons it has been asking for from the United States. So here you have the FBI citing an identified news organization reporting that Donald Trump, candidate number one, was actually had a different view from the consensus position of party number one, the Republican Party, and that Trump was for a milder position on the Ukraine, which, just for our audience to remember, would be exactly the position of Barack Obama. Don't send heavy weapons to Ukraine because that will actually accelerate the conflict in the eastern part of the country. So based on the fact that Trump had a different point of view and that news media outlets were reporting this, that became the basis on which the FBI says that Carter Page, a volunteer in the campaign, should also be suspect. I mean, that represents, I would say, a grave danger and a chilling headwinds for people who engage in political speech, for people who may have a point of view different from the consensus of the U.S. empire or the neoconservative establishment. And just holding that view, according to this FISA application, makes you suspect. I mean, read page 22 and page 23. As Lucy and Jim said, most of it's redacted, or a big part of it. But page 22 and 23, 21, 22, 23, if you read those pages, you cannot help but come to the conclusion that the FBI had, quote, no evidence, but was citing the point of view, the news outlets that said that the Trump campaign had a different political orientation and thus became suspect.
The other point is that it's a violation of international treaties and international law to send weapons to places that are hotspots, where there is conflict going on. You're not supposed to be allowed. Not that the American government pays much attention or any attention to it, but it's his point of view of not sending the weapons is actually in line with international law.
Jim, go ahead. What are your thoughts about this? You know, the intermingling between foreign policy and domestic criminal investigations.
Imagine that someone said, oh, a candidate from a major party, the Democratic Party, was known, or from the Republican Party, was known to want to change the Iran deal, to get out of the Iran deal. The Israelis, they were talking to Israeli officials who were trying to persuade them to get out of the Iran deal. And some of them were suggesting that maybe they didn't think the Iran deal was a good thing. Therefore, they must be foreign agents. Nobody would ever say that. You know, and that was going on, guarantee. The Israelis were all over the place telling every candidate, you got to get out of the Iran deal. We want you out of the Iran deal, right? That's a consequent policy change that went against the consensus of the American foreign policy establishment that everybody knows the Israelis were doing. Nobody's going to be indicted for that or be considered or called or have a FISA application to surveil their phones 24/7, all their communication 24/7 over that. This is the hypocrisy of the selective outrage about foreign interference and pressure from from foreign governments and trying to, you know, foreign governments or foreign individuals expressing to people in American politics that they would like certain changes or not certain changes. You know what I mean? It's just, it's kind of outrageous, and it's horrifying to see this going on, and the hypocrisy and selective outrage about it, you know, and that, as Brian said, you can get a FISA application for this, you know, and this is taken seriously. I read a news report that said, oh, he has this, I wrote a thing about it. In fact, it was a famous Stephanopoulos interview of Trump during the campaign saying, how could you possibly not want these arms going to Ukraine? You're a Russian bot. You know, essentially it was that. And it was like crazy. What are you talking about? That was Barack Obama's issue. And beside the fact, they just sent the weapons to Ukraine. So, you know, where are all these Russian agents?
Brian, go ahead. I mean, it's not an uncommon thing if you look through U.S. history for people who have dissenting views on international affairs, on foreign policy, on the questions of war and peace, to be surveilled by the government. Now, we're not saying that Carter Page or anybody associated with the Trump campaign are, you know, some sort of principled anti-war activists, but their opinions do fall outside of this extremely hawkish consensus that dominates Washington, that dominates, you know, all facets of the U.S. government that's concerned with foreign policy. Talk a little bit about that history and how that sort of plays into this relatively consistent use of the surveillance state and the law enforcement apparatus to enforce the U.S. empire's war-making designs.
So, I mean, if you think back about it, if you think back to the past 60 years, since we're now in a new Cold War, let's use the old Cold War as a point of reference. There was a debate within the State Department over how the United States should approach the new government in China after Mao Zedong and the Communist Party of China came to power on October 1st, 1949. But the witch hunt that was unleashed against those who thought, hey, maybe we should have good relations instead of bad relations with China, which now, of course, is official policy since the early 1970s. They have good relations. But for those who said, look, the Chinese government is legitimate. It is the government. It should have its seat at the UN. Those elements within the State Department were driven out of office. Some of them were driven into jail cells. But the whole debate, if for people who might remember or might have heard about it, was who lost China, as if China really belonged to the United States. And somehow some American officials, because of misguided policies, lost this jewel to American domination. And as a consequence, there was this terrible witch hunt, and people went to jail, people went to prison. And if anybody got up and said, hey, let's have good relations with China, this was back in 1949 or 50 or 51 or 52, or throughout the 50s, in fact, you were labeled to be somehow like an extension of Red China, or you were an agent of a foreign power. We're right back where we are. If people even advocate peace with Russia, for instance, they become suspect. I mean, here you have Mike Pompeo over the weekend and Trump threatening all-out war against Iran. And people who are consider themselves liberal and progressive, at least those who have been organized by Move On and Democratic Party front groups, have been out in front of the White House chanting USA, 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 waving American flags, not because they're threatening to annihilate Iran, but because Trump went against the consensus of having normalized or better relations with Russia. I mean, that's what's going on. We're having the FBI and the CIA or the NSA, the elements of government repression and suppression, along with the mass media, creating a public sort of social pressure on everyone who doesn't go along with the consensus. And so it's all elements of pressure on people to conform. And the conformity, the witch hunt, is extremely dangerous. You know, 10 years ago, we taught everyone, hey, the old Cold War was a bad thing. The old witch hunt was a bad thing. But here we are, and there's too many uncritical voices, people going along to demonstrate, I think, that they themselves are not witches by joining the witch hunt. So again, it's a well-trod territory for American foreign policy and for conforming public opinion to the dominant views.
Jim Kavanaugh, I want to ask you about Carter Page. It seems to me, even with the very heavy redactions that you mentioned, it seems that Carter Page was wronged with at least the second and third of these FISA warrants. The government has to go back every, I think it's 90 days, to renew the warrant. there was really nothing tying him to Russia. There was really no proof of any kind that he had been recruited by the Russians, either wittingly or unwittingly. And yet the FISA court kept renewing this thing over and over again. Why is that? And do you think that now that the methodology is public, there might be some changes?
Well, I'd love to see someone think about that and talk about that critically. The Republicans are going to complain about this because look at the thin gruel. There's nothing really there that gave a justification for this. But what you're saying and what I'm saying, I think, is that this FISA court is a rubber stamp. It was made to be a rubber stamp. And it's extremely easy for these agencies, the FBI, to come in and say, oh, you know, we heard this from this guy. We read it in the newspaper. So let us spend another 90 days because we didn't get anything the first 90 days. So give us another 90 days to try and surveil this guy's communications. And it's just that we should be talking here about the FISA court, and you know, which was set up by Clinton as supposedly, oh, we're going to have a method where there's a judicial review for surveilling American citizens. But of course, there's no other person in the room except the FBI agents and who send their reversion of the story to the judges, and the judges are picked as the guys who are most likely to just put a rubber stamp. It's very rare that a FISA application is refused. And what we should be talking, and the Republicans, the hypocrisy of the Republicans in this case, is that they say, oh, look, this is terrible, but that's what's going on with the FISA court in general. And they won't say that when the people they don't like are given FISA warrants to be surveilled with the same kind of thin gruel.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're joined by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. We're joined from France by Lucy Commissar. She's a longtime author, editor, and investigative journalist. And we're also joined by Brian Becker. Lucy, you're a journalist. You've broken many, many very important stories. You're an award-winning writer. I wanted to get your opinion professionally about how the mainstream corporate media has been covering all of this. You know, the extensive use of anonymous sources. You know, the use of different formulations and innuendo, you know, different sort of levels of confidence. How do you assess the way that, you know, say CNN or MSNBC or Fox News or any of these big outlets, the New York Times, have been covering the Mueller investigation, Russiagate generally? What's your take?
Well, two things. One is they seem to think it's unnecessary to have any evidence except that an FBI person or a DNI, remember Clapper, who lied about the surveillance, and they accept the FISA request was signed by Clapper, right? Who lied to the Congress? No, we don't surveil the American public. So we know that they don't pay serious attention to getting real evidence. The area that I've been dealing with, which is almost worse because there is opposite evidence, is the Browder story and the William Browder story.
Yeah, please tell us about that.
Okay, very essential in establishing a mood that Putin is a bad guy. So in 2012, he started lobbying for the Magnitsky Act and got it passed the next year. The reason is he had cheated the Russians of $70 million, $40 million of taxes on shares that were sold, and another $30 million because he had bought Gazprom shares, which were only supposed to be for Russian citizens, but he used some shell companies. So he owed $70 million, and the Russians went after him on that, and they denied his attempt to come back into the country. He says, "Oh, they threw me out of the country, and they denied my extension of the visa." Well, yeah, he was a crook, and it had been going on for a number of years. He refused to pay that. He got people to support his demands for this act, which was to attack particular Russians that were named because they said, and this guy's lied all the time. It just shows how bad the media is. He says that Magnitsky, his lawyer, had discovered a big scam. Well, in 2007, Magnitsky was his tax accountant from 1997, and he did all the tax evasion for Browder. And if you look at the interrogations of Magnitsky before he was arrested, it's all about the taxes. And if you listen to what Browder said to the Judiciary Committee in July of 2017, it's all about my lawyer, and they killed him, and so on. If you look at his And I have this on my website. It's so available. I send it to journalists whenever I see them lying, but no responses. He testified in U.S. federal court on the Prevazon case, which is a case against a Russian accused of laundering $1.9 million out of $230 million of money that was defrauded, the Russian Treasury was defrauded. He had to tell the truth because when you lie to the Judiciary Committee, they really don't care. They're just looking for an anti-Putin meme. When you lie before the court and there are lawyers on the other side, you are in big trouble. So they said, well, did this guy go to law school? Did he have a law degree? No. And who told – one of the things he did on the tax evasion was – one of the departments in Russia set up a tax availability to cut your taxes way down if you hired disabled people. A lot of them would be the veterans of Afghanistan, and also if you invested in the region. So he wrote his tax accountant, that's Magnitsky, oh yes, we hired, and he had the names of people, he paid people to use their passports. And we invested. Well, the point is the companies there were shells to hold shares. They had no employees. They had no investment. It was total fraud. All of the documents are available. And the media, and I'm talking the New York Times, the Washington Post, MSNBC, everybody, everything is available. And it's under oath. And it's in the U.S. court, Southern District of New York, that Browder has created this story, which is totally fake. Totally fake, and the mainstream media is either they're stupid or they're lazy or they're doing it deliberately. But sometimes I think, well, they can't be that stupid because, you know, it's really easy to get into PACER, which is the database for all of the U.S. Courts, and so easy to get all of these documents where he and other people also had to speak under oath, and they tell the truth about what really went on. So this guy did not find out anything, and he was part of the corruption. And of course, and he wasn't murdered because Browder sent a lot of documents to the Physicians for Human Rights in Cambridge, Mass., and they looked at all the documents, and they came back with the truth, saying he got terrible medical care, and he died of pancreatitis and really awful medical care. By the way, I read some of the stuff in the U.S., and it's not unusual to find treatment in prisons in the U.S. not that different. But he was. But Browder goes on and says to the Judiciary Committee and everybody who listens, this guy was beaten for an hour by eight thugs, government thugs. But the material that he gave to the Physicians for Human Rights shows some pictures, and there are bruises on his wrists and on his ankles. And I thought, these eight riot squad thugs are beating this guy with truncheons for an hour, and they aim only for his ankles and his wrists. There's not a mark, because there were pictures on autopsy. There's not a mark on the face, on the head, on the body. Doesn't anybody out there have any brains? You know, do you not suggest that, well, this is really strange. The guy was murdered by these people with the truncheons, and there's no evidence on his body. And of course, he had handcuffs on, which is, you know, a reason why he could have had some bruises on his wrist. But to me, that is even worse. Well, the part we're talking about is very bad because it's the Cold War. It's setting up the Cold War. But I think that Browder played a role in this, in establishing the fact that the media does not care about the truth, even when it's forced on them, as in the Browder case.
Very important point. We're going to have to leave it right there. We've been joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. His most recent piece is Fighting Fake Stories, The New Yorker, Israel, and Obama. We've been joined from France by Lucy Commissar. She is a longtime author, editor, and investigative journalist. And we were also joined by our own Brian Becker. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Welcome back, Chris.
Hey, Walter, John. Great to talk to you both again.
So over the weekend, you were at a really interesting event called the HOPE Conference. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the HOPE Conference, Hackers on Planet Earth, happens every 2 years. This was the 12th HOPE Conference. And, you know, really, it was a fantastic event, very informative, a lot of very brilliant people in the hacker community. And when we say hacker, we don't mean, you know, people sitting in the dark, you know, getting into systems they shouldn't be in. We mean people who are curious, people who are exploring, and particularly people who are exploring technology. And, you know, there was a lot that came out of this to talk about, you know, and a lot of organizing actually that happened. You know, I think we just need to point out, people, if you follow some news sources like Unicorn Riot, unfortunately, some white nationalists tried to get into the conference, and very quickly, conference attendees found out that they had been allowed in and put out a very quick statement that I also signed on to, calling out the conference organizers for their apolitical stance. And I'm mentioning this because I think it's so important to understand that in technology, as in most other facets of life, we can't be apolitical, because apolitical actually means taking the position and taking a position of support for white nationalists, bigots, for all sorts of things. So I was very actually impressed by the quick response by the majority of conference attendees against this policy of letting these nationalists in. And I should say that they also include a man named Thomas Ryan, who is already known as a private security mercenary that infiltrated Occupy Wall Street in 2011. And eventually, most of these people were removed because of the organizing that was done by conference attendees, including Chelsea Manning, Barrett Brown, and others. And this gives me hope also, because it comes also in the context of workers at Amazon and Salesforce and Google standing up to their own companies to demand that technology be a place for good, not for evil. So I wanted to start out with that. Some very interesting things that came out of this weekend. First of all, a little tidbit. You guys both know, right, that little green lock at the top of your web browser that says, you know, this is a secure website, right?
Yep.
So the standards behind that are organized by a group called the IETF. It's the Internet Engineering Task Force. It's a semi-public, semi-open consortium of people, corporations, governments who kind of put these standards together and then release them. Turns out, so there's a new version of that security called TLS that's coming out, and it's starting to be adopted across the internet, and it's got some really great new security features. Something we learned over the weekend was that a consortium of big banks lobbied against some of the most important security features in this new version of the secure standard, because it would impact their profits. Because it would be harder for them to kind of monitor traffic and debug stuff on their own networks. So they actually tried to get this new standard to not be as secure as it is, because it came down to their bottom line, which was very surprising. Thankfully, they weren't successful. Thankfully, the new security stuff is out there in the standard and is starting to be implemented. But I found that a very interesting tidbit to learn from somebody who was in those conversations.
You know, I wanted to ask also about the conference. We hear so much about conferences like this, but so few of us have ever been to one. I've certainly never been to one. And I've wondered what it is exactly that goes on at these conferences. Chris, you've mentioned people like Barrett Brown, for example. Barrett's a friend of mine. And he talks and talks, and I don't understand a single word he's saying. Is that what happens at these conferences when all these hackers get together? What do they talk about? What do they accomplish there?
We talk about whatever it is we're interested in, or whatever it is we want to learn about. You know, I went to a lot of information security-related sessions. There were three tracks of sessions from Friday through Sunday. But I also went to a number on very interesting topics that I actually didn't know much about, like shortwave radio. It's people who are curious. People who like exploring and learning and who have that basis around technology coming together to talk about what interests them and to share what they've discovered, which is really the basis of the open hacker community. It's a really wonderful environment for the most part.
Chris, you flagged a lot of interesting stories for us to talk about this week. And I think one that is particularly, dire is, so the headline is Walmart files patent for audio surveillance technology to monitor employees and customers. I mean, this kind of relates back to what you were saying a few minutes ago about how, you know, you can't be neutral, right? You know, these tools, the technology that's created could be used for good or evil. And so, you know, you can't be neutral. You have to pick a side because the technology has the potential for both. Tell us more about what Walmart's been up to.
Yeah, so Walmart filed a patent. And when this patent was discovered, Walmart quickly said, well, quote, we file patents frequently, but that doesn't mean the patents will actually be implemented. I mean,
wow, what a relief.
But that goes to another issue entirely with the entire patent and intellectual property system. But there's no reason to think that they're not going to, because I don't really trust anything coming out of Walmart PR, and there's no reason to trust them. They want to have audio recordings of basically every transaction that you have with a cashier at Walmart. And as part of the patent is for computer analysis. So they can actually analyze your voice and your cashier's voice or your customer's voice if you are a cashier to see, you know, how happy was that person? Did you try to upsell them on whatever the upsell of the day is? You know, all of those things. And it's just really the micromanagement and the invasion of privacy, just that, you know, in the minor conversations that a person has at work or that a person has when they're going shopping, that there's no need for. It's taking customer satisfaction surveys that we all, you know, get all the time and really automating them without the input of the customer. Now, on the other side, this is also going to help profile the customer because you can tag a specific time and register to a credit card transaction. And this could also be used to say, you know, this customer was in a bad mood and they bought, you know, these things at this time. So we should market more of these things to them.
That's sick.
It's something that happens all the time. And it's, you know, that currently happens online constantly when you buy something on Amazon or you click an ad on Google, all of these things.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. There was another issue that you flagged for us, and there are several articles around this. And I think this is one of the most important issues of our time. And that's facial recognition technology and software and what it's used for. Now, I understand that facial recognition technology can be used at border crossings, airports, to track terrorists, etc. But that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about everybody being tracked through facial recognition software. Go ahead.
Yeah, three really interesting stories, some that I just found out about this weekend and some that came out this weekend. So there is a body cam maker, the police body cams. The major one is called Axon. They have put out a patent. Speaking of patents, I put out a patent for capturing data and doing facial recognition from their body cam. So this means that if the police body cams are on, when they send the data back to their main servers, they can do facial recognition analysis to see maybe who was around at a certain time and certain place. Or if you're at a protest or a rally, who was in front of that officer? Who was even at that protest to begin with? They don't say what they're going to do with that information, but it's clearly going to be in the hands of law enforcement, which shares data very liberally between different agencies. That's a huge, huge issue of privacy. Axon also said, you know, just because we filed a patent doesn't mean we're going to do it. But it's clear that they've been working on the technology. In order to file the patent, they've been working on it and they've been testing it out. And just a few months ago, they said they would never do facial recognition. And then this patent was discovered. So I think that's something that people need to be aware of, especially if you're involved in political work and in a confrontation with police or in any situation with police, really, at all, that if they're using Axon body cameras in the very near future, they could have the ability to do facial recognition right from that video.
Yeah, and you know, this was a big debate in the struggle against police brutality when it really heated up around the time of the Ferguson uprising in 2014. There was, you know, a trend that was very, very moderate, and this was also coming from a lot of politicians and elected officials, that, you know, the solution to police brutality is to make sure that everybody has a body camera. And if the cops have body cameras, then, you know, problem solved. And, you know, what a lot of the other people, I would say, you know, the large majority of activists who are, you know, truly grassroots and in the streets were saying is that, well, look, I mean, the way to tackle police brutality, I mean, there are a number of ways, but one of the most important is for these cops to go to jail, right? For there to be actual consequences and accountability, rather than these reforms that sort of don't place the blame on anybody. And that, you know, in fact, it's kind of concerning. Perhaps it strengthens this national surveillance state to have every police officer recording everybody everywhere they go. And I think, you know, that was sometimes dismissed as sort of conspiratorial thinking. But what we're seeing several years later is just that, right?
That's absolutely right. So having these major databases of people's faces, even if you're not involved in a police incident, you could be walking by and they're going to capture your face just because you're walking by. You could walk by an incident with the police and there you are and your face is being tagged.
And they'll save that information forever. And that's collected without a warrant, which to me is a violation of the Constitution, but they just hold it in a database. And so even though you're utterly innocent of any crime, they know exactly where you've been and when you were there and what you were doing and probably who you were talking to. And it's, that's the end of privacy in America.
And who you were with. And, you know, speaking of that, you know, we should talk about this conference was in New York City, and two interesting things came out of New York City recently. One is that Andrew Cuomo wants to put in, you know, has this multi-million dollar project, over $100 million, I believe, to install new cameras in all the bridges and tunnels. Well, it turns out those cameras are also going to be able to do facial recognition on top of license plate recognition. And it's not just facial recognition of the driver of a car. It's facial recognition of anyone who's in the car. So that should be very scary. So, you know, if you go through an Easy Pass or something, right, you know that they're reading your Easy Pass tag, or if you go through, you know, without one, they're going to get your license plate and they're going to send you a ticket or a bill. But if you pay cash, you should have this expectation that you can, like, be in a car, pay cash, and not have your picture taken because there's no need for it, right? But now they're going to be automatically taking photos and doing facial recognition on every single car and vehicle, and they can do it on every person in those vehicles coming into and going out of New York City on the bridges and tunnels.
Millions and millions of people.
Oh, so many millions of people, absolutely. In addition, if your listeners have been into New York City recently, they've probably seen these new, basically the replacements for payphones, Link NYC. They're kiosks. They give you information on what's going on in the city, directions, all those kind of things. They have charging plugs for your phone if you need to, charge your phone up real quick. Turns out they have cameras on the sides of them. And these are just on the sidewalks every block or two, especially in Midtown Manhattan. So they have cameras on the sides of them.
For what reason, Chris? Why? I don't see any reason why they would have cameras on the side of them.
I don't see any reason either, but I'm not trying to collect surveillance data on millions of people.
Yeah, that's it right there.
That's it. That's exactly what they're going to. That's exactly what's happening there. The city won't talk about what that information is being used towards. Link NYC, the organization, won't talk about what that information is being used for. They just put out denials and say it's being used to monitor, you know, foot traffic and all of that. But of course, foot traffic means people. And people mean identities. With the prevalence of facial recognition technology, like we've been talking about, it would be completely within the realm of possibility that there's going to be facial recognition applied to this. I would recommend to listeners as well, if you're in New York and your phone is dying, it might be tempting, don't plug your phone into one of these, because you don't know what information a Link NYC kiosk could possibly collect from your phone, but you also don't know what a malicious person has attached to that USB port and could be sending out, you know, and that's not even about the kiosk itself. Somebody could attach, you know, a very invisible, malicious piece of hardware to it and collect data off your phone. So don't use those. Go buy a charger at a kiosk or a gas station somewhere else.
You flagged another privacy-related story for us to talk about this week about Venmo. I use Venmo. It did strike me as odd that every transaction is by default public. Like, I kind of don't want any of my financial transactions to be public, But there's this article you found. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so by default, every transaction you make on Venmo, which is just a quick way, you hook it up to your bank account or debit card, and it's a quick service to send money to your friends, to whoever. People use it often, you know, split a tab at dinner or, you know, pay somebody back for gas money and whatnot. Every transaction by default is public. And there's a very easy way through Venmo's public websites and a thing called an API, which lets programmers get information from the system to go and see all the transactions that are coming through in real time. Now, you might not think that that's such a big deal if you're just paying somebody for gas or whatever, but this gets into the situation of creating associations. So it's very public that, Walter, I'm going to send you money because we had dinner and, you know, I owe you $10 for the burritos, right? And now we have to go out for burritos, Walter. But, you know, that's the kind of thing.
No, I used it for that yesterday. I used that to split a tab yesterday with somebody. Yeah.
See, there you go. And there's nothing wrong with that. And we should also mention Venmo is owned by PayPal. They were purchased a number of years ago, but by PayPal, which is a big data company, effectively. Yes, they are effectively, you know, they're sort of a bank, a credit card company. But all of these companies are also big data companies. Really quick fix for this is to just go into your Venmo app, go into your settings, and change the privacy of your transactions. And when somebody sends you a transaction, if they made it public, you can actually go in and edit that transaction and change it to private. And that's all you have to do. It's that easy. And it prevents your transaction from showing up publicly to anyone who wants to see it in the world. We should mention, too, that when Venmo was asked about this, their response was that Venmo is a social network. I've never thought of Venmo as a social network. I'm not, you know, in the habit of liking and commenting on things. You don't post photos or anything like that. But that's Venmo's attitude, right, is that this is a social network, which really means collecting data. So that's why I'd encourage people to go ahead and just take a second and change the settings in the Venmo app.
Could they then sell, like, the data that they have about people's purchasing or spending habits to advertisers? I mean, that's sort of like the holy grail of marketing is information about, like, I think particularly the demographic that's most likely used Venmo, which is younger people. I think that's sort of where advertisers are the most hungry for information, because the way that younger people consume information is so different than other generations because of the advent of the internet and the, you know, related means of communication. Could this be like a gold mine for Venmo, because they can just sort of package all this, you know, personal spending information and sell it to advertising firms and market research firms?
It absolutely is. And that's absolutely why they're collecting this. You know, on Venmo, you actually have to put a reason in for your transaction. I can't just send you $10 with no reason. I actually have to put in why I'm sending that. And it could be, you know, they offer all these cute emojis and icons for it, you know, a burrito, a salad, you know, gas, but they're collecting all of that information. This gets into a much deeper topic, though, called fintech, financial technology. So we all know that everyone has a credit score, right? This number between 350 and 800 that effectively determines whether or not you can get a loan, buy a house, get a car, in some cases, even get a job. And, you know, this number, right, this number is really controls so much of our lives. Apartments are now, you know, they're asking for credit scores just to rent an apartment, not just a down payment and monthly rent, but they got to check your credit score. Of course, credit scores by far favor the rich and punish the poor. The lower your credit score, the more money and interest you're actually going to get charged. Or maybe you can't get a certain job, or maybe you can't get an apartment that is in a safe and affordable building. And you have to settle for, you know, subpar housing if you don't have a good credit score. And your interest rates are going to be so much higher if you have a poor credit score. But there's more than that out there. There's an entire financial technology, fintech industry that is collecting all of this data on us. So let me ask you guys, do either of you have a cat?
I do not.
Nope.
No? Okay. Do you prefer chunky or smooth peanut butter?
Yeah, smooth.
I'll agree. I'll agree with that.
Okay. So I'm going to also guess now that neither of you own a VW Beetle.
That's also true.
Okay. So it was shown statistically by Volkswagen that if you owned a cat, at least one, and you liked chunky peanut butter, you were statistically more likely to be in the market and consider a VW Beetle.
You know, it's, I'm laughing, but it's not funny. This is very serious.
Right. Another data point on that is it turns out that Republicans are more likely to drink bourbon and Democrats are more likely to drink gin.
Oh, for heaven's
sake. Or we should say people on the right of the political spectrum like bourbon, people on the left like gin. I'm proud to go against that grain, but you know, that's another thing that they can guess. Now, let's say you go buy some bourbon or gin with your grocery store member card, right? Well, that's tied to you, and then that's packaged up and sold. Now, it's not just about your political leanings, which then can be obviously used to sell ads. So Volkswagen says, give me all the people who are buying cat food and chunky peanut butter, and I'm going to send them ads for a car, right? But this is also going to be used, and it is being used, to impact credit decisions and life insurance policies and all of these other things. All of this data that we don't even know that we're giving out is actually being used by all of these companies to make quick, instant decisions on whether or not you can be approved for things like housing or a student loan. We don't even think about these things happening, right? Most people don't think about that when you're using your Stop and Shop card. But that's the reality of it.
You know, that's true, actually. And people have been talking about that part of it for years, that whenever you go into a grocery store and buy groceries and you scan your card, they keep track of everything that you buy, not just right there while you're standing there, but in perpetuity. And then when they sell that information, other companies are able to more directly target us. So we have less and less privacy, less and less freedom every time one of these technologies is developed in the United States.
Chris, is this true for like credit cards too, or debit cards? I mean, are any electronic transactions potentially vulnerable to this kind of like data mining?
Oh, yeah. Your bank, your credit card companies, they obviously know where you're spending money. They might not know directly what you're buying, but depending on where the store is and the amount of, or what kind of store it is and the amount of your purchase, certainly glean certain information from that. And then they're going to go to these, actuarial tables effectively to say people who buy at this, even down to the time of day you make a purchase. So if you buy something between the hours of like midnight and 6 a.m., effectively, you're more likely to regret the purchase and maybe even not pay for it or take longer to pay it off.
Wow.
Because, maybe it was something you did in the middle of the night, you were sleepy, you had a few drinks, whatever it is. But if you make a purchase between 12 p.m. and 6 p.m., you're actually more likely to be happy with your purchase and pay it off quicker. And that's just another thing that they've been able to see. Now, if you're making a whole series of transactions, let's say past midnight, credit card companies are going to take that into account when you go and ask them to lower your interest rate or to get a higher higher limit on your card. And they're not going to tell you that. They're just going to say it's because of your credit history. They're not going to say it's because you buy stuff at 2 a.m.
I remember hearing too, and I said this once before on the show, that on Amazon, if you're shopping on Amazon and you click on something more than once, or if you put it on a wish list, Amazon will automatically send it to the distribution center nearest to your address so that if you end up going through with a purchase, you can receive it either that same day or the next day. It's an odd way of marketing, but it also shows you how closely they follow our every move.
Right. And, this is what we go back to using technology for good. That's a great logistics technology to have, right? So if we know, for example, there's a natural disaster, let's use that same technology to move this stuff really quickly to a distribution center where we can get it to the people in need. And I want to go back just a second, too. So I've used all these examples of how they're going to track you and assess your worthiness of basic services or credit or whatever. They also look at it and say, if you make the majority of your purchases on a phone, and they also look at the model of phone that you have. If you're just making it on a phone and maybe it's not the brand new iPhone, they're going to assume that you are lower income and less credit worthy as well. If you're not making it on a new phone, a tablet or a laptop or desktop computer. So this is just really punishes poor people even more than the current credit system. And I'm pointing this out too because people are up in arms about this new credit policy in China, which I think has been completely overblown. And, I think we're running out of time this week and it's a broad topic, so maybe we can talk about it next week. But this new credit policy in China that's coming up, this so-called social credit, This is happening right here in the United States, and to a greater extent, actually. And it's happening with private entities, not public entities. And we need to be aware of how our information is being used.
We've got about 3 minutes left, Chris, and we want to talk about the tech tip of the week. These are always so important, and we want to make sure you have enough time. So go right ahead.
Yeah, so I want to talk this week about private browsing mode. So you've probably seen in your browser, it's got something called private mode, private browsing, incognito mode in Chrome. You know, there's a number of different names for it. You'd think, you know, at first that it's just something that you can turn on and you're browsing in private. But that's not actually the case, right? So it doesn't protect the websites you're going to from your internet service provider. It doesn't protect those websites from knowing who you are, especially if you log into them. All it does is prevent that information from going into your browser history. So when you close that window, when you go up to your history menu, you're not going to see, you know, what you were just shopping for on Amazon. Now, this can be useful, right? If you're looking on for gifts online for your significant other and you share a laptop, you know, it can be great for you to get some ideas and just put them in, you know, look at them on Amazon, but your significant other isn't going to be able to see that. But people should not be under the illusion that using private browsing mode gives you any privacy from your ISP, from, you know, potential government snooping, from tracking software, or from the website that you're on in the first place. It just takes that record off your computer in your web browser that you visited that website.
Is there any way to be safe in your browsing?
You can be safer. You know, there's no such thing as completely safe. The safest thing is to not do something in this case. But you can use something called a VPN, a virtual private network, that will encrypt the traffic. So if you're worried about your internet service provider seeing where you're going, or somebody in your household potentially seeing what websites you're going to, you can sign up for a VPN service. I use one called Private Internet Access. They do cost money, but I would say never use a free VPN, because as we know, if you're not paying for it, you are the product. Now, the VPN still doesn't protect you from the website knowing who you are. It doesn't protect you from all of that stuff, but it protects traffic locally on your network. Now, this is very useful, for example, for victims of domestic violence, for people who are concerned about surveillance from law enforcement locally, or from their ISP, so that those agencies or people can't see where you're going from your computer, but it's not foolproof and it doesn't give you 100% privacy. So just be aware that there is no perfectly secure way to browse the internet.
Okay, we will leave it there. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.